content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today, Friday, November 22nd, 2019, is the 56th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. In his honor, from the June 17, 1944 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read an account of his battle to save himself and his men while adrift on a PT boat in the South Pacific during World War II. Written by Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Hersey. And now, Survival by John Hersey. Our men in the South Pacific fight nature when they are pitted against her with a greater fierceness than they could ever expend on a human enemy. Lieutenant John F. Kennedy, the ex-ambassador's son and lately a PT skipper in the Solomons, came through town the other day and told me the story of his survival in the South Pacific. I asked Kennedy if I might write the story down. He asked me if I wouldn't talk first with some of his crew. So I went up to the Motor Torpedo Boat Training Center at Melville, Rhode Island, and there, under the curving iron of a Quonset hut, three enlisted men named Johnston, McMahon, and McGuire filled in the gaps. It seems that Kennedy's PT, the 109, was out one night with a squadron patrolling Blackett Strait in mid-Solomons. Blackett Strait is a patch of water bounded on the northeast by a volcano called Columbangara, on the west by the island of Vella Lavella, and on the south by the island of Gizo, and a string of coral-fringed islets, and on the east by the bulk of New Georgia. The boats were working about 40 miles away from their base on the island of Rendova, on the south side of New Georgia. They had entered Blackett Strait, as was their habit, through Ferguson Passage between the coral islets and New Georgia. The night was a starless black, and Japanese destroyers were around. It was about 2:30. The 109, with three officers and 10 enlisted men aboard, was leading three boats on a sweep for a target. An officer named George Ross was up on the bow, magnifying the void with binoculars. Kennedy was at the wheel, and he saw Ross turn and point into the darkness. The man in the forward machine gun turret shouted, "Ship at 2 o'clock." Kennedy saw a shape and spun the wheel to turn for an attack. But the 109 answered sluggishly. She was running slowly on only one of her three engines, so as to make a minimum wake and avoid detection from the air. The shape became a Japanese destroyer, cutting through the night at 40 knots and heading straight for the 109. The 13 men on the PT hardly had time to brace themselves. Those who saw the Japanese ship coming were paralyzed by fear in a curious way. They could move their hands, but not their feet. Kennedy whirled the wheel to the left, but again the 109 did not respond. Ross went through the gallant but futile motions of slamming a shell into the breech of the 37-millimeter anti-tank gun, which had been temporarily mounted that very day, wheels and all, on the foredeck. The urge to bolt and dive over the side was terribly strong, but still no one was able to move. All hands froze to their battle stations. Then the Japanese crashed into the 109 and cut her right into. The sharp enemy forefoot struck the PT on the starboard side about 15 feet from the bow and crunched diagonally across with a racking noise. The PT's wooden hull hardly even delayed the destroyer. Kennedy was thrown hard to the left in the cockpit, and he thought, "This is how it feels to be killed." In a moment, he found himself on his back on the deck, looking up at the destroyer as it passed through his boat. There was another loud noise, and a huge flash of yellow-red light, and the destroyer glowed. Its peculiar, raked, inverted Y stack stood out in the brilliant light, and later in Kennedy's memory. There was only one man below decks at the moment of collision. That was McMahon, the engineer. He had no idea what was up. He was just reaching forward to slam the starboard engine into gear when a ship came into his engine room. He was lifted from the narrow passage between two of the engines and thrown painfully against the starboard bulkhead aft of the boat's auxiliary generator. He landed in a sitting position. A tremendous burst of flame came back at him from the day room where some of the gas tanks were. He put his hands over his face, drew his legs up tight, and waited to die. But he felt water hit him after the fire, and he was sucked far downward as his half of the PT sank. He began to struggle upward through the water. He had held his breath since the impact, so his lungs were tight, and they hurt. He looked up through the water. Over his head he saw a yellow glow, gasoline burning on the water. He broke the surface and was in fire again. He splashed hard to keep a little island of water around him. Johnston, another engineer, had been asleep on deck when the collision came. It lifted him and dropped him overboard. He saw the flame and the destroyer for a moment. Then a huge propeller pounded by near him, and the awful turbulence of the destroyer's wake took him down, turned him over, and held him down, shook him, and drubbed on his ribs. He hung on and came up in water that was like a river rapids. The next day, his body turned black and blue from the beating. Kennedy's half of the PT stayed afloat. The bulkheads were sealed, so the undamaged watertight compartments up forward kept the half-hull floating. The destroyer rushed off into the dark. There was an awful quiet, only the sound of gasoline burning. Kennedy shouted, "Who's aboard?" Feeble answers came from three of the enlisted men, McGuire, Maurer, and Albert, and from one of the officers, Tom. Kennedy saw the fire only 10 feet from the boat. He thought it might reach her and explode the remaining gas tanks, so he shouted, "Over the side!" The five men slid into the water, but the wake of the destroyer swept the fire away from the PT. So after a few minutes, Kennedy and the others crawled back aboard. Kennedy shouted for survivors in the water. One by one they answered. Ross, the third officer, Harris, McMahon, Johnston, Zinser, Starkey, enlisted men. Two did not answer, Kirksey and Marnie, enlisted men. Since the last bombing at base, Kirksey had been sure he would die. He had huddled at his battle station by the fantail gun with his Kapok life jacket tied tight up to his cheeks. No one knows what happened to him or to Marnie. Harris shouted from the darkness, "Mr. Kennedy! Mr. Kennedy! McMahon is badly hurt!" Kennedy took his shoes, his shirt, and his sidearms off, told Maurer to blink a light so that the men in the water would know where the half-hull was, and then Kennedy dived in and swam toward the voice. The survivors were widely scattered. McMahon and Harris were 100 yards away. When Kennedy reached McMahon, he asked, "How are you, Mac?" McMahon said, "I'm all right. I'm kind of burnt." Kennedy shouted out, "How are the others?" Harris said softly, "I hurt my leg." Kennedy, who had been on the Harvard swimming team 5 years before, took McMahon in tow and headed for the PT. A gentle breeze kept blowing the boat away from the swimmers. It took 45 minutes to make what had been an easy 100 yards. On the way in, Harris said, "I can't go any farther." Kennedy, of the Boston Kennedys, said to Harris, of the same hometown, "For a guy from Boston, you're certainly putting up a great exhibition out here, Harris." Harris made it all right and didn't complain anymore. Then Kennedy swam from man to man to see how they were doing. All who had survived the crash were able to stay afloat since they were wearing life preservers. Kapok jackets shaped like overstuffed vests, aviators' yellow May vests, or air-filled belts like small inner tubes. but those who couldn't swim had to be towed back to the wreckage by those who could. One of the men screamed for help. When Ross reached him, he found that the screaming man had two life jackets on. Johnston was treading water in a film of gasoline which did not catch fire. The fumes filled his lungs, and he fainted. Tom towed him in. The others got in under their own power. It was now after 5 a.m., but still dark. It had taken nearly 3 hours to get everyone aboard. The men stretched out on the tilted deck of the PT. Johnston, McMahon, and Ross collapsed into sleep. The men talked about how wonderful it was to be alive and speculated on when the other PTs would come back to rescue them. Maurer kept blinking the light to point their way. But the other boats had no idea of coming back. They had seen a collision, a sheet of flame, and a slow burning on the water. When the skipper of one of the boats saw the sight, he put his hands over his face and sobbed, "My God, my God!" He and the others turned away. Back at the base, after a couple of days, the squadron held services for the souls of the 13 men, and one of the officers wrote his mother. George Ross lost his life for a cause that he believed in stronger than any one of us, because he was an idealist in the purest sense. Jack Kennedy, the ambassador's son, was on the same boat and lost his life also. The man that said the cream of a nation is lost in war can never be accused of making an overstatement of a very cruel fact. When day broke, the men on the remains of the 109 stirred and looked around. To the northeast, 3 miles off, they saw the monumental cone of Kulamagata. There, the men knew, 10,000 Japanese swarmed. To the west, 5 miles away, they saw Vela La Vela, more Japs. To the south, only a mile or so away, they could actually see a Japanese camp on Gizo. Kennedy ordered his men to keep as low as possible so that no moving silhouettes would show against the sky. The listing hulk was gurgling and gradually settling. Kennedy said, "What do you want to do if the Japs come out? Fight or surrender?" One said, "Fight with what?" So they took an inventory of their armament. The 37-millimeter gun had flopped over the side and was hanging there by a chain. They had one Tommy gun, six 45 caliber automatics, and one 38. Not much. "Well," Kennedy said, "what do you want to do?" He picked up the ship's lantern, a heavy battery affair, 10 inches by 10 inches, still wrapped in the kapok jacket. He said, "If I find a boat, I'll flash the lantern twice. The password will be Roger, and the answer will be Wilco." He walked toward the water. After 15 paces, he was dizzy, but in the water he felt all right. It was early evening. It took half an hour to swim to the reef around the next island. Just as he planted his feet on the reef, which lay about 4 feet under the surface, he saw the shape of a very big fish in the clear water. He flashed the light at it and splashed hard. The fish went away. Kennedy remembered what one of his men had said a few days before. "These barracuda will come up under a swimming man and eat his testicles." He had many occasions to think of that remark in the next few hours. Now it was dark. Kennedy blundered along the uneven reef in water up to his waist. Sometimes he would reach forward with his leg and cut one of his shins or ankles on sharp coral. Other times he would step forward onto emptiness. He made his way like a slow-motion drunk, hugging the lantern. At about 9 o'clock, he came to the end of the reef alongside Ferguson Passage. He took his shoes off and tied them to the life jacket, and then struck out into open water. He swam about an hour until he felt he was far enough out to intercept the PTs. Treading water, he listened for the muffled roar of motors, getting chilled, waiting, holding the lamp. Once he looked west and saw flares and the false gaiety of an action. The lights were far beyond the little islands, even beyond Gizo, 10 miles away. Kennedy realized that the PT boats had chosen, for the first night in many, to go around Gizo instead of through Ferguson Passage. There was no hope. He started back. He made the same painful promenade of the reef and struck out for the tiny island where his friends were. But this swim was different. He was very tired, and now the current was running fast, carrying him to the right. He saw that he could not make the island, so he flashed the light once and shouted, "Roger! Roger!" to identify himself. On the beach, the men were hopefully vigilant. They saw the light and heard the shouts. They were very happy because they thought the Kennedy had found a PT. They walked out onto the reef, sometimes up to their waists in water, and waited. It was very painful for those who had no shoes. The men shouted, but not much because they were afraid of Japanese. One said, "There's another flash." A few minutes later, a second said, "There's a light over there." A third said, "We're seeing things in this dark." They waited a long time, but they saw nothing except phosphorescence and heard nothing but the sound of waves. They went back, very discouraged. One said despairingly, "We're going to die." Johnson said, "Ah, shut up. You can't die. Only the good die young." Kennedy had drifted right by the island. He thought he had never known such deep trouble. But something he did shows that unconsciously he had not given up hope. He dropped his shoes, but he held on to the heavy lantern, his symbol of contact with his fellows. He stopped trying to swim. He seemed to stop caring. His body drifted through the wet hours, and he was very cold. His mind was a jumble. A few hours before, he had wanted desperately to get to the base at Rendova. Now, he only wanted to get back to the little island he had left that night. But he didn't try to get there. He just wanted to. His mind seemed to float away from his body. Darkness and time took the place of a mind in his skull. For a long time he slept, or was crazy, or floated in a chill trance. The currents of the Solomon Islands are queer. The tide shoves and sucks through the islands and makes the currents curl in odd patterns. It was a fateful pattern into which Jack Kennedy drifted. He drifted in it all night. His mind was blank, but his fist was tightly clenched on the kapok around the lantern. The current moved in a huge circle, west past Gizo, then north and east past Columbangata, then south into Ferguson Passage. Early in the morning, the sky turned from black to gray, and so did Kennedy's mind. Light came to both at about 6. Kennedy looked around and saw that he was exactly where he had been the night before when he saw the flares beyond Gizo. For a second time, he started home. He thought for a while that he had lost his mind and that he had only imagined that he was repeating his attempt to reach the island. But the chill of the water was real enough. The lantern was real. His progress was measurable. He made the reef, crossed the lagoon, and got to the first island. He lay on the beach a while. He found that his lantern did not work anymore, so he left it and started back to the next island where his men were. This time, the trip along the reef was awful. He had discarded his shoes, and every step on the coral was painful. This time, the swim across the gap where the current had caught him the night before seemed endless. But the current had changed. He made the island. He crawled up on the beach. He was vomiting when his men came up to him. He said, "Ross, you try it tonight." And then he passed out. Ross, seeing Kennedy so sick, did not look forward to the execution of the order. He distracted himself by complaining about his hunger. There were a few coconuts on the trees, but the men were too weak to climb up for them. One of the men thought of seafood, stirred his tired body, and found a snail on the beach. He said, "If we were desperate, we could eat these." Ross said, "Desperate? Hell, give me that. I'll eat that." He took it in his hand and looked at it. The snail put its head out and looked at him. Ross was startled, but he shelled the snail and ate it, making faces because it was bitter. In the afternoon, Ross swam across to the next island. He took a pistol to signal with, and he spent the night watching Ferguson Passage from the reef around the island. Nothing came through. Kennedy slept badly that night. He was cold and sick. The next morning, everyone felt wretched. Planes, which the men were unable to identify, flew overhead, and there were dogfights. That meant chaps as well as friends. So the men dragged themselves into the bushes and lay low. Some prayed. Johnson says, "You guys make me sore. You didn't spend 10 cents in church in 10 years, then all of a sudden you're in trouble and you see the light." Kennedy felt a little better now. When Ross came back, Kennedy decided that the group should move to another, larger island to the southeast, where there seemed to be more coconut trees and where the party would be nearer Ferguson Passage. And again, Kennedy took McMahon in tow with the strap in his teeth, and the nine others grouped themselves around the timber. This swim took 3 hours. The nine around the timber were caught by the current and barely made the far tip of the island. Kennedy found walking the quarter mile across to them much harder than the three-hour swim. The cuts on his bare feet were festered and looked like small balloons. The men were suffering most from thirst, and they broke up and opened some coconuts lying on the ground and avidly drank the milk. Kennedy and McMahon, the first to drink, were sickened, and Tom told the others to drink sparingly. In the middle of the night, it rained, and someone suggested moving into the underbrush and licking water off the leaves. Ross and McMahon kept contact at first by touching feet as they licked. Somehow they got separated, and, being uncertain whether there were any Japs on the island, they became frightened. McMahon, trying to make his way back to the beach, bumped into someone and froze. It turned out to be Johnston, licking leaves on his own. In the morning, the group saw that all the leaves were covered with droppings. Bitterly, they named the place Bird Island. On this fourth day, the men were low. Even Johnston was low. He had changed his mind about praying. McGuire had a rosary around his neck, and Johnston said, "McGuire, give that necklace a working over." McGuire said quietly, "Yes, I'll take care of all you fellas." Kennedy was still unwilling to admit that things were hopeless. He asked Ross if he would swim with him to an island called Nauru, to the southeast and even nearer Ferguson Passage. They were very weak indeed by now, but after an hour's swim, they made it. They walked painfully across Nauru to the Ferguson Passage side, where they saw a Japanese barge aground on the reef. There were two men by the barge, possibly Japs. They apparently spotted Kennedy and Ross, for they got into a dugout canoe and hurriedly paddled to the other side of the island. Kennedy and Ross moved up the beach. They came upon an unopened, rope-bound box and, back in the trees, a little shelter containing a keg of water, a Japanese gas mask, and a crude wooden fetish shaped like a fish. There were Japanese hardtack and candy in the box, and the two had a wary feast. Down by the water, they found a one-man canoe. They hid from the imagined Japs all day. When night fell, Kennedy left Ross and took the canoe with some hardtack and a can of water from the keg out into Ferguson Passage. But no PTs came, so he paddled to Bird Island. The men there told him that the two men he had spotted by the barge that morning were natives who had paddled to Bird Island. The natives had said that there were Japs on Nauru, and the men had given Kennedy and Ross up for lost. Then the natives had gone away. Kennedy gave out small rations of crackers and water, and the men went to sleep. During the night, one man, who kept himself awake until the rest were asleep, drank all the water in the can Kennedy had brought back. In the morning, the others figured out that he was the guilty one. They swore at him and found it hard to forgive him. Before dawn, Kennedy started out in the canoe to rejoin Ross on Nauru. But when day broke, a wind arose and the canoe was swamped. Some natives appeared from nowhere in a canoe, rescued Kennedy, and took him to Nauru. There, they showed him where a two-man canoe was cached. Kennedy picked up a coconut with a smooth shell and scratched a message on it with a jackknife. The message read, 11 alive, native nose posit and reefs, Nauru Island, Kennedy. Then he said to the natives, Rendova, Rendova. One of the natives seemed to understand. They took the coconut and paddled off. Ross and Kennedy lay in a sickly daze all day. Toward evening it rained, and they crawled under a bush. When it got dark, conscience took hold of Kennedy, and he persuaded Ross to go out into the Ferguson Passage with him in the two-man canoe. Ross argued against it. Kennedy insisted. The two started out in the canoe. They had shaped paddles from the boards of the Japanese box, and they took a coconut shell to bail with. As they got out into the passage, the wind rose again and the water became choppy. The canoe began to fill. Ross bailed and Kennedy kept the bow into the wind. The waves grew until they were 5 or 6 feet high. Kennedy shouted, "Better turn around and go back!" As soon as the canoe was broadside to the waves, the water poured in and the dugout was swamped. The two clung to it, Kennedy at the bow, Ross at the stern. The tide carried them southward toward the open sea, so they kicked and tugged the canoe, aiming northwest. They struggled that way for 2 hours, not knowing whether they would hit the small island or drift into the endless open. The weather got worse. Rain poured down, and they couldn't see more than 10 feet. Kennedy shouted, "Sorry I got you out here, Barney." And Ross shouted back, "Well, this would be a great time to say I told you so, but I won't." Soon the two could see a white line ahead and could hear a frightening roar, waves crashing on a reef. They had got out of the tidal current and were approaching the island all right. But now they realized that the wind and the waves were carrying them toward the reef. But it was too late to do anything, now that their canoe was swamped, except hang on and wait. When they were near the reef, a wave broke Kennedy's hold, ripped him away from the canoe, turned him head over heels, and spun him in a violent rush. His ears roared and his eyes pinwheeled, and for the third time since the collision, he thought he was dying. Somehow, he was not thrown against the coral, but floated into a kind of eddy. Suddenly, he felt the reef under his feet. Steadying himself so that he would not be swept off it, he shouted, "Barney!" There was no reply. Kennedy thought of how he had insisted on going out in the canoe, and he screamed, "Barney!" This time, Ross answered. He, too, had been thrown on the reef. He had not been as lucky as Kennedy. His right arm and shoulder had been cruelly lacerated by the coral, and his feet, which were already infected from earlier wounds, were cut some more. The procession of Kennedy and Ross from reef to beach was a crazy one. Ross's feet hurt so much that Kennedy would hold one paddle on the bottom while Ross put a foot on it, and then the other paddle forward for another step. And then the first paddle forward again, until they reached sand. They fell on the beach and slept. Kennedy and Ross were awakened early in the morning by a noise. They looked up and saw 4 husky natives. One walked up to them and said in an excellent English accent, "I have a letter for you, sir." Kennedy tore the note open. It said, "On His Majesty's service to the senior officer, Nauru Island, I have just learned of your presence on Nauru Island. I am in command of a New Zealand infantry patrol operating in conjunction with U.S. Army troops on New Georgia. I strongly advise that you come with these natives to me. Meanwhile, I shall be in radio communication with your authorities at Rendova, and we can finalize plans to collect balance of your party. Lieutenant Wincote. P.S. We'll warn aviation of your crossing Ferguson Passage. Everyone shook hands, and the four natives took Ross and Kennedy in their war canoe across to Bird Island to tell the others the good news. There, the natives broke out a spirit stove and cooked a feast of yams and sea ration. Then they built a lean-to for McMahon, whose burns had begun to rot and stink, and for Ross, whose arm had swelled to the size of a thigh because of the coral cuts. The natives put Kennedy in the bottom of the canoe and covered him with sacking and palm fronds in case Japanese planes should buzz them. The long trip was fun for the natives. They stopped once to try to grab a turtle and laughed at the sport they were having. 30 Japanese planes went over low toward Rendova, and the natives waved and shouted gaily. They rowed with a strange rhythm, pounding paddles on the gunwales between strokes. At last, they reached a censored place. Lieutenant Wincott came to the water's edge and said formally, "How do you do, Lieutenant Wincote?" Kennedy said, "Hello, I'm Kennedy." Wincote said, "Come up to my tent and have a cup of tea." In the middle of the night, after several radio conversations between Wincote's outfit and the PT base, Kennedy sat in the war canoe waiting at an arranged rendezvous for a PT. The moon went down at 11:20. Shortly afterward, Kennedy heard the signal he was waiting for, 4 shots. Kennedy fired 4 answering shots. A voice shouted to him, "Hey, Jack!" And Kennedy said, "Where the hell you been?" The voice said, "We got some food for you." Kennedy said bitterly, "No thanks, I just had a coconut." A moment later, a PT came alongside. Kennedy jumped onto it and hugged the men aboard, his friends. In the American tradition, Kennedy held under his arm a couple of souvenirs, one of the improvised paddles and the Japanese gas mask. With the help of the natives, the PT made its way to Bird Island. A skiff went in and picked up the men. In the deep of the night, the PT and its happy cargo roared back toward base. The squadron medic had sent some brandy along to revive the weakened men. Johnston felt the need of a little revival. In fact, he felt he needed quite a bit of revival. And after taking care of that, he retired topside and sat with his arms around a couple of roly-poly mission-trained natives. And in the fresh breeze on the way home, they sang together a hymn all three happened to know. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Little ones to him belong, they are weak, but he is strong. Yes, Jesus loves me, yes, Jesus loves me. And now, from the May 22, 2017 issue of the New Yorker magazine, an article in the Life and Letters section entitled Trying to Remember JFK, on the Centenary of His Birth, Seeking the Man Behind the Myth, by Thomas Mallon. On November 8, 1960, I voted for Richard Nixon. I had turned 9 the week before. According to my fourth-grade report card, from that September, I stood 4 feet 1 1/4 inches tall and weighed 55 pounds, small enough to be permitted entry into the curtained voting booth in the Stewart Manor School on Long Island, where my father let me pull the lever for Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge. It was a reach. During Nelson Rockefeller's long Albany reign, the Republican ticket occupied the top row on New York State's mechanical ballot. John F. Kennedy's Catholicism cut little ice with many of the Irish ex-New Dealers who lived on our street. Their liking of Ike proved to be more than a fling, and by 1960 they were beginning to feel permanently at home in the Republican Party. Affection for my wry, sweet-tempered father, meanwhile, left me immune to the much of JFK's chivalric glamour. My father always called him Kennedy, a pronunciation meant to sound hot wasp, which, from his point of view, this rich, educated New Englander might as well have been. But he also viewed Kennedy with an easygoing detachment, rather as Kennedy tended to view himself. He laughed along with the affectionate Vaughn Meader's impersonations and the Mad Magazine spoofs of JFK that I added to his reading of the New York World Telegram, a middle-brow broadsheet, unaware that, along with men's hats and women's cotton gloves, it was on the brink of death. I recall how Phyllis Mendel, the 23-year-old teacher who had notated my height and weight, assigned our class to watch the first Kennedy-Nixon debate. As Kennedy's inaugural arrived, Mrs. Mendel gave us a letter-writing exercise. We could send our congratulations to the incoming president or offer the outgoing one of our thanks. I loyally chose Eisenhower and duly received an acknowledgment postmarked February 6, 1961 from Washington. The card inside was headed Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Eisenhower's bold, printed signature, not dissimilar to John F. Kennedy, sat where a stamp should have been, my introduction to the franking privilege, and as I look at the envelope more than five decades on, I'm arrested by its little bits of archaism. There is no zip code, and the addressee, Master Thomas Mallon, might as well have been Penrod Schofield. The following June, in her last set of report card comments, Mrs. Mendel observed that Tommy has expressed great interest in being a politician someday. The excitement of the election had clearly lingered. Kennedy would have been 100 years old on May 29, 2017. His centenary brings with it new books, the most notable of which is probably The Road to Camelot, a wearyingly titled but provocative reconstruction of his five-year campaign for the White House. The authors Thomas Oliphant and Curtis Wilkie, both veterans of the Boston Globe, locate the effort's origin in a cardiac doubleheader from the summer of 1959-55, when President Eisenhower and Lyndon Johnson, then Senate Majority Leader, suffered serious heart attacks. Joseph P. Kennedy, confident of Johnson's recovery, but not of Ike's, suggested to LBJ that he consider a race for president in 56, with Kennedy's son, the junior senator from Massachusetts, as a running mate. Johnson wasn't amenable to the idea, but JFK's vice presidential prospects were nearly fulfilled when Adlai Stevenson, trying to jumpstart his second doomed campaign against Eisenhower, told delegates at the Democratic Convention to make their own choice for the bottom of the ticket. Out in Chicago, Jack Kennedy made a fast, strenuous grab at the nomination and posted a respectable loss to the Tennessee Senator Estes Cavalver. Months before, Kennedy's young aide, Theodore Sorensen, had run an extensive set of numbers showing how a Catholic on the Democratic ticket could stem recent defections to the Republican Party by groups like those newly suburbanized Irish Catholics on Dover Parkway in Stewart Manor. Sorensen's report held that Al Smith's crushing defeat in 1928 had resulted from his stance against prohibition, not his religion. Smith would have done worse still had he not been a Catholic. Kennedy spent the fall of 56 campaigning for Stevenson, but picked his own venues, one that could redound to his benefit 4 years later. A decision to try for the presidency in 1960 was made weeks after Stevenson's defeat at Thanksgiving dinner in a Hyannisport. Joe Kennedy had already pledged whatever it takes from his own fortune. Oliphant and Wilkie suggest that the actual rationale for Kennedy's candidacy lay in his understanding of celebrity, as well as a confession he made to a group at Washington's Metropolitan Club. "It's not that I have some burning thing to take to the nation, it's just, why not me?" This is the Kennedy now frozen in Isabel McIlvaine's statue outside the Massachusetts State House. A youthful figure, regal and a little aloof, whose high, straight-ahead gaze isn't so much visionary as unapproachable. According to The Road to Camelot, Kennedy was regarded by some Senate colleagues as an indifferent Democrat with occasionally independent tendencies. And he needed to do more than the usual amount of broken field running to please the Democratic Party's sturdy but mad coalition of segregation and social justice. Between 1956 and 1958, looking southward, he hinted at disagreement with Eisenhower's decision to send troops to Little Rock, offered campaign help to George C. Wallace, a candidate for the Alabama governorship, and put a Confederate legislature into profiles in courage. Still, he had more work to do with the party's left than with its right. Kennedy took a forthright stance against French colonialism in Algeria, previewing his Peace Corps-style competition with the Soviets in the newly independent Third World. The columnist Joseph Alsop thought that Kennedy had potential to become a, quote, Stevenson with balls, end quote. Though the senator's principal inter-party antagonist, Eleanor Roosevelt, still longed for Stevenson himself, unforgiving of Kennedy's softness toward Senator Joseph McCarthy, Mrs. Roosevelt is believed to have been the first to recommend that JFK show, quote, less profile and more courage, end quote. The former First Lady was brutally brusque to him during the 56th convention. When she finally endorsed him well into the 1960 campaign, she conceded in conversation that Stevenson might not have made such a good president after all. I almost peed in my pants, Kennedy told a crony who had heard the admission. With Kennedy, politics aside, everything was intimate, aspirant, literally seen from below. From the inaugural ceremony, I was home from school for a snow day, to the assassination, I was absent with a cold playing chess with my uncle. I experienced most of the 35th presidency lying on our braided living room rug, head tilted upward toward the television. Rhetorically, the administration was an oral experience heard through the radio-style mesh of the TV speaker. Some of its less remembered lines fastened themselves to me more lastingly than the ghost-written flourishes that have entered historical memory. Quote, it shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. End quote. On October 22, 1962, the syllogistic nature of this sentence seemed to impress me as much as the possibility it discussed. These were the words I reported to my father when he came through the door, arriving home from work past the middle of the speech. A year later, when Kennedy made his civil rights address, it was a rhetorical question, one that followed a list of indignities suffered by American Negroes that registered with me. Quote, then, who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? End quote. This exercise in empathy had guaranteed appeal for an imagination susceptible to the weekly premises of the Twilight Zone. I could try to do this in the same way I had tried to see myself as Henry Bemis, the Burgess Meredith character who breaks his glasses just after realizing he has a lifetime of peaceful post-nuclear apocalypse reading ahead of him. My paternally inspired devotion to Nixon remained weirdly keen, but Kennedy was now my leader, and I was ready to put my undersized shoulder to the wheel. Project Mercury, an Eisenhower program, I feel conservatively compelled even now to point out, had found in the new president a leader who looked as if he could himself be one of the seven astronauts in whose progress I took an obsessive interest. I was most comfortable surrendering to Kennedy when he was in the company of those pilots, making post-flight calls, pinning on the medals, or just being at Cape Canaveral with them, wearing his Ray-Bans. The administration was a family story, part drama, the loss of a two-day-old Patrick Kennedy during its last summer, and part raucous sitcom, the pool parties at the home of JFK's kid brother Bobby, the high-strung beaver to his Wally. The patriarch interested my own father, who always called him Papa Joe and admired him, however grudgingly, as a roguish man whose interest in his children was evident and intense. Oliphant and Wilkie insist that Jack Kennedy was more and earlier independent of the old man than is generally believed. The ambitions fueled by Papa Joe's dubiously made money were JFK's own. We are now as far from John Kennedy's time as he was from Theodore Roosevelt's. Available living memories are growing scarce. Here in Washington, the Kennedy Center, visible from my study window, feels as much an established marble fact as the Lincoln Memorial, a few blocks away. Only one of Kennedy's eight siblings survives, his 89-year-old sister Jean, who visits a son in the Watergate, more or less next door to the Kennedy Center. As I write, a single Buckeye sits on my desk, a souvenir from John Glenn's Ohio funeral, brought to me by the daughter of his successor in orbit, Scott Carpenter, the subject of an early novel of mine. He, too, is gone, like the rest of the original seven. And now, from the February 27, 2017 edition of the New Yorker magazine, a story by Elizabeth Colbert, Why Facts Don't Change Our Minds. In 1975, researchers at Stanford invited a group of undergraduates to take part in a study about suicide. They were presented with pairs of suicide notes. In each pair, one note had been composed by a random individual, the other by a person who had subsequently taken his own life. The students were then asked to distinguish between the genuine notes and the fake ones. Some students discovered that they had a genius for the task. Out of 25 pairs of notes, they correctly identified the real one 24 times. Others discovered that they were hopeless. They identified the real note in only 10 instances. As is often the case with psychological studies, the whole setup was a put-on. Though half the notes were indeed genuine, they'd been obtained from the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office. The scores were fictitious. The students who'd been told they were almost always right were, on average, no more discerning than those who had been told they were mostly wrong. In the second phase of the study, the deception was revealed. The students were told that the real point of the experiment was to gauge their responses to thinking they were right or wrong. This, it turned out, was also a deception. Finally, the students were asked to estimate how many suicide notes they had actually categorized correctly and how many they thought an average student would get right. At this point, something curious happened. The students in the high score group said that they thought they had, in fact, done quite well, significantly better than the average student, even though, as they'd just been told, they had zero grounds for believing this. Conversely, those who'd been assigned to the low score group said that they thought they had done significantly worse than the average student, a conclusion that was equally unfounded. Once formed, the researchers observed dryly, impressions are remarkably perseverant. A few years later, a new set of Stanford students were recruited for a related study. The students were handed packets of information about a pair of firefighters. Frank K. and George H. Frank's bio noted that, among other things, he had a baby daughter and he liked to scuba dive. George had a small son and played golf. The packets also included the men's responses on what the researchers called the risky conservative choice test. According to one version of the packet, Frank was a successful firefighter who, on the test, almost always went with the safest option. In the other version, Frank also chose the safest option. But he was a lousy firefighter who'd been put on report by his supervisor several times. Once again, midway through the studies, the students were informed that they'd been misled and that the information they'd received was entirely fictitious. The students were then asked to describe their own beliefs. What sort of attitude toward risk did they think a successful firefighter would have? The students who received the first packet thought that he would avoid it. The students in the second group thought that he'd embrace it. Even after the evidence, quote, for their beliefs has been totally refuted, people failed to make appropriate revisions in those beliefs, end quote, the researchers noted. In this case, the failure was particularly impressive since two data points would never have been enough information to generalize from. The Stanford studies became famous. Coming from a group of academics in the 1970s, the contention that people that can't think straight was shocking. It isn't any longer. Thousands of subsequent experiments have confirmed and elaborated on this finding. As everyone who's followed the research, or even occasionally picked up a copy of Psychology Today, knows, any graduate student with a clipboard can demonstrate that reasonable-seeming people are often totally irrational. Rarely has this insight seemed more relevant than it does right now. Still, an essential puzzle remains. How did we come to be this way? In a new book, The Enigma of Reason, the cognitive scientists Hugo Mercier and Dan Sperber take a stab at answering this question. Mercier, who works at a French research institute in Lyon, and Sperber, now based at the Central European University in Budapest, point out that reason is an evolved trait, like bipedalism or three-color vision. It emerged on the savannas of Africa and has to be understood in that context. Stripped of a lot of what might be called cognitive science ease, Mercier and Sperber's argument runs more or less as follows. Humans' biggest advantage over other species is our ability to cooperate. Cooperation is difficult to establish and almost as difficult to sustain. For any individual, freeloading is always the best course of action. Reason developed not to enable us to solve abstract, logical problems, or even to help us draw conclusions from unfamiliar data. Rather, it developed to resolve the problems posed by living in collaborative groups. Reason is an adaptation to the hypersocial niche humans have evolved for themselves, Mercier and Sperber write. Habits of mind that seem weird or goofy or just plain dumb from an intellectualist point of view prove shrewd when seen from a social interactionist perspective. Consider what's become known as confirmation bias. The tendency people have to embrace information that supports their beliefs and reject information that contradicts them. Of the many forms of faulty thinking that have been identified, confirmation bias is among the best catalog. It's the subject of entire textbooks worth of experiments. One of the most famous of these was conducted, again, at Stanford. For this experiment, researchers rounded up a group of students who had opposing opinions about capital punishment. Half the students were in favor of it and thought that it deterred crime. The other half were against it and thought that it had no effect on crime. The students were asked to respond to two studies. One provided data in support of the deterrence argument, and the other provided data that called it into question. Both studies, you guessed it, were made up and had been designed to present what were, objectively speaking, equally compelling statistics. The students who had originally supported capital punishment rated the pro-deterrence data highly credible and the anti-deterrence data unconvincing. The students who'd originally opposed capital punishment did the reverse. At the end of the experiment, the students were asked once again about their views. Those who'd started out pro-capital punishment were now even more in favor of it, and those who opposed it were even more hostile. If reason is designed to generate sound judgments, then it's hard to conceive of a more serious design flaw than confirmation bias. Imagine Mercier and Sperber suggest a mouse that thinks the way we do. Such a mouse, bent on confirming its belief that there are no cats around, would soon be dinner. To the extent that confirmation bias leads people to dismiss evidence of new or underappreciated threats, the human equivalent of the cat around the corner, it's a trait that should have been selected against. The fact that both we and it survive, Mercier and Sperber argue, proves that it must have some adaptive function, and that function they maintain is related to our hypersociability. Mercier and Sperber prefer the term my-side bias. Humans, they point out, aren't randomly credulous. Presented with someone else's argument, we're quite adept at spotting the weaknesses. Almost invariably, the positions we're blind about are our own. A recent experiment performed by Mercier and some European colleagues neatly demonstrates this asymmetry. Participants were asked to answer a series of simple reasoning problems. They were then asked to explain their responses and were given a chance to modify them if they identified mistakes. The majority were satisfied with their original choices. Fewer than 15% changed their minds in step two. In step three, participants were shown one of the same problems, along with their answer, and the answer of another participant who'd come to a different conclusion. Once again, they were given the chance to change their responses, but a trick had been played. The answers presented to them as someone else's were actually their own, and vice versa. About half the participants realized what was going on. Among the other half, suddenly people became a lot more critical. Nearly 60% now rejected the responses that they'd been earlier satisfied with. This lopsidedness, according to Mercier and Sperber, reflects the task that reasons evolved to perform, which is to prevent us from being screwed by the other members of our group. Living in small bands of hunter-gatherers, our ancestors were primarily concerned with their social standing and with making sure that they weren't the ones risking their lives on the hunt while others loafed around in the cave. There was little advantage in reasoning clearly, while much was to be gained from winning arguments. Among the many, many issues of our forebears didn't worry about were the deterrent effects of capital punishment and the ideal attributes of a firefighter. Nor did they have to contend with fabricated studies or fake news or Twitter. It's no wonder, then, that today reason often seems to fail us. As Mercier and Sperber write, this is one of the many cases in which the environment changed too quickly for natural selection to catch up. We've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.